say you're on now. Your name?
Erik Andersson.
Where are you from?
Sweden.
Mm-hmm. When were you born, Erik?
1911, 17th of March.
Mm-hmm. What brought you to Canada?
Well, to change my living and get work.
Mm-hmm. What year did you come?
1928.
Oh yeah. And what were you doing in Sweden?
I was a miller.
A what?
A miller.
What's that?
A flour mill.
Oh, a miller. Yeah. Oh yeah.
And when I come to Canada, I come to Winnipeg first, and then to Wetaskiwin, Alberta, mm-hmm. and worked on a farm.
Oh yeah.
And from Alberta, I went to Fort St. John, British Columbia, in the Peace River District, and homesteaded.
Oh yeah. Were you married then?
No.
No.
I was single. Mm-hmm. And times were hard, and it was no outlook, so I left in 1932 and went out in the prairies to work. And times were hard, and I traveled on the freight, rode the freights during the Depression, and worked every place it was possible to get work.
Pretty hard.
Pretty hard. And I eventually ended up in Moose Jaw. I worked for the CPR.
What were you on the track? Or
on the track.
Do you remember what your pay was?
22 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the summer. In the winter, I was fortunate to get work for a Swift Canadian company in Moose Jaw, and I worked there in the winter.
What did you do?
I worked in the freezer department, and we were outing too. We were shipping cheap beef meat to Japan.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. You see, they were forcing the farmers to sell their beef cattle because they were so dry. You see, they couldn't feed them, so they bought them in for 2 cents a pound. And we were packing this and shipping it to Japan. From Moose Jaw, I went to Winnipeg. I worked in the Thai camps out at Seven Sisters, Dismal, Ingall, Ontario.
What were you doing out there?
Making ties.
Oh yeah.
Railroad ties.
Oh, yeah.
And in the winter. In the summer, I worked for farmers out at Rowland, Deloraine, and Portage La Prairie. And when the war was started in 1939, I joined up on the 7th of September, 1939. And we lived out of barracks the first few months.
Tell me, Eric, did you ever do any military training before you ever joined up? Did you take any training
no,
in Sweden?
No, no.
Was your father or your family military people?
Well, everybody serves their military training. That's compulsory.
In Sweden?
In Sweden, yeah.
Had you, or were you too young when you were?
I was only 17 when I left.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. So, I joined Al-Sula, I guess, tell a story too. I joined the Princess Patricia first, when I was an alien, I had no citizen papers. So I joined them on the 3rd of September, and they let me go on the 6th of September, because I had no citizen papers. And he told me, he said, if you go down to the Grenadiers and enlist with them, you tell them that you're born in Alberta, and they'll take you in. So I did that. I went down, and the sergeant asked me, well, where are you born? And I said, Wetaskiwin, Alberta, this is Swedish settlement. And they took me in. And I jag ändå har med en begynner på grann av det. Om den andra är trendad, eller vi trendad men inte bärs. Vi levde ut, han levde en Balmoral Street. Det är ett indrag som man får rummen, barnen i Washington. In December we moved into Tuxedo Barracks and we were training for keepsake. In May we left for Jamaica. We stayed approximately 16 months in Jamaica.
How did you like military life?
Oh, I enjoyed it.
You liked it very much? Oh,
liked it very much.
Mm-hmm. And did you like the training, like the machine guns and the guns?
Oh, yes.
So you took to it very well.
I took to it very well. I enjoyed it, and it was, you didn't have to look day to day for a job, let us face it. Mm-hmm. This, you could go down on the unemployment office and mark it, but got that straight on.
Oh, yeah.
Used line up there. They maybe stay there all day and would be nothing there. You come back the next day, the same thing, winter or summer. And if you are fortunate to get something to do, well, it was usually maybe $15 a month, maybe $5 a month. And so this getting into in the army, even that you had to go overseas, well, you got look at after, you had food, you had clothes, you had nothing to worry about to look after.
Mm-hmm. And you took to it.
So I was quite took it all in. Mm-hmm. I was willing to obey and do.
How'd you like Jamaica?
Oh, I loved it. It was just something out of this world. Nice and warm. And the food was fine, and it was just out of this
just
world.
Just made for you, eh?
It just made for me, and I like hot climate.
Uh-huh.
So I was very fine.
What did you do to make it?
Well, we went on guards for the German and Italian prisoners. Uh-huh. And a funny thing happened there. I was talking to a German one day. He could speak Swedish. So he said to me, he said, "It ain't gonna be too long before you're ready to leave Jamaica. Before you're gonna be inside the wires." And I told him, I said, you're just way off. It can't possibly happen. And well, little did I realize that I was where in a couple of months I will be the same thing myself.
These prisoners over there, these German prisoners, they weren't soldiers, they were civilians, were they, or what?
Well, they were Navy personnel.
They were Navy personnel.
Yeah, and merchant Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were well looked after. They had privileges that you wouldn't, well, we just couldn't consider. They could go outside and get food. They had a canteen. They could buy anything we could buy.
They were paid?
Then they get money. Mm-hmm. And, well, then we didn't think too much about this thing. Then later on, when we got into prison camp, and it was impossible to buy, we got 10 cents. I got 10 cents. And you couldn't buy anything. A cigarette cost $20. So you could trade it for one egg for a cigarette. I used to smoke one time, and I quit it when I got wounded. So I used to trade cigarettes for food. And I realized that once you got down to this trading business, it's a bad way, because you trade your food away, and the food was so scarce, you didn't have nothing to eat. And there was fellows who was very, had a habit of smoking, and he couldn't break it. And he would trade our food away to get a cigarette. And gradually he got so weak and sick that he didn't, he died.
Oh, yeah. Because they didn't nourish themselves.
No, they didn't know. And the food we had was so small quantities that you had to absorb and hold it. Because if you let it go away, you got weak on, weak on. You couldn't stand it. So when we left Jamaica and we arrived here in Winnipeg, we all got leaves. I went to visit some friends of mine in Moose Jaw, seeing I'd been there, but in here all my number of years. I had a lot of friends there, a lot of Scandinavian people there. And from then on, I went back to Winnipeg and we shipped out. Well, we arrived in Vancouver and they put us on board a boat, Aberdeen, an Australian boat, I believe, for New Zealand.
Did you have any idea where you were going?
Well, yes. I realized that it would either be Philippines or India, and not exactly Hong Kong. Then there were so many rumors, and once we got to Vancouver, we know that you were going east, that was all us doing, and it could only be Philippines or India. And we look forward to that. I hear a lot about Hong Kong, and I know there was a free port. You could buy most anything you wanted, cheap. And we had lots of money. So we got on this Aberdeen, and the first meal we had on the boat was tripe and onions. And you never had such an uproar in your life. But I still can laugh a little, because it's the funniest thing that ever happened to Canadians too, because tripe and onions is about the last thing you can give to Canadians.
Yeah.
Man, we put up with it. And the next day there was mutton. And they have a way to cook it that, well, you, it's a shame you wouldn't do that to an animal. So they, when the orderly officer come in and they, in the mess, like, all you heard was, bah!
That's what the men said, eh?
Oh, yes. So, and they changed the cooks after that. We got our own cooks, began their cooks, and they did all the cooking from then on. Then, whenever I think about it, I still laugh over it, because I had eaten tripe and onions before, so it was nothing really new to me. And to Canadians, it is new. Other Canadians would never touch it, would never think of buying it.
Yeah.
So we arrived in, oh yes, we had some wanted to leave the ship in the harbor of Vancouver, and she sailed out, pulled out in the middle of the harbor and laid overnight. And the next day we started out for Hawaii. We arrived in Hawaii and we were laying to harbor there, to the side there, and we were not allowed to go on shore. And they had the bands, and there was entertainment come down and dancing and was singing for us down there. And we left Hawaii and for Philippines. And we didn't get off ship in Philippines either. And it was a beautiful harbor and a beautiful city. here. We left Manila, arrived in Hong Kong, and it was a different city also. We saw sand tents and the city by itself floating on water, and it was quite a difference. We unloaded and marched into Shemsepo camp.
What was your first impression of Hong Kong?
Well, it's mysterious. It's have some, in a lot of ways it's big, and you see this is something you've never seen before, and it's so different that it's, it can astonish you. The people are different. The life is different, and the outlook of life is way different to white people. Men, it's a city worth well seeing, because once we got in and we were quarantined to barracks for a couple of weeks, I guess, and then we got allowed to go out, got a pass and go out, and I went around and visited different streets. And in Hong Kong, the trades are divided up. You can find a street where they make ivory, you find a street where they make silverware, the same with silk, where they sewed and embroidered. And leather goods have a different state and a different setting of the city. You find them one by one. And I used to go down and have a look at this and see how it was done. And here you find small children sitting, sewing, embroidering blouses and dresses and shirts, and boys making little ivory things out of ivory. I went on to the thieves market in Hong Kong, and here everything that is stolen in Shanghai eventually ends up in Hong Kong and the thieves market. You can buy anything from silver, diamonds, guns, household articles, so anything you can think of. There's nothing that is not sold. And one thing that fascinated me more than anything was that you could go in a shop if you wanted to buy gold or silver. So they had it in long bars, about 6 inches in length, and or maybe a half an inch in width. You could pay the fellow in cash money, American money or Canadian pound notes, and they would weigh out a such amount of silver or a such amount of gold out of that bar, and you would have a piece of gold in your pocket.
So you could buy and trace everything?
Anything, mm-hmm. Anything. And that fascinated me more than anything.
Mm-hmm. And you saw some beautiful craftsmen, I saw.
Oh, it's nothing, there's no other place where they make things like that. Carvings, something fantastic.
These ivory carvings they make over there, where is the ivory from? Elephant tusks?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I see some of the little Chinese ivory carvings.
Oh, it's just beautiful.
And I suppose you've seen them, the carvings on furniture.
Yeah. Oh, it's really remarkable how they can do it.
And the Oriental seems to be good craftsmen,
yeah,
doesn't he?
That's right. I saw I went in an ivory shop where they make ivory, and they make ivory balls. They overset about 4 inches in diameter, and inside it's a ball to begin with, And inside are six little balls inside, and they are all carved just miniature. So, and I asked this elderly man, he spoke English. And he told me the story of this ivory ball and the man who was holding it. And it has to do with the beginning of the earth. From the base right up to the, and the man is holding the earth. The ball is the earth. And the man is, this Chinaman is holding this ball on his shoulder like Hercules.
You read about that? Oh yes, like Hercules
and
holding
the Chinese,
the world.
Yeah, and the Chinese have the same myth about that. Only they have the people say the Chinese have the idea people come from fishes.
Oh yes, that's it. But their heritage is so old.
It's everything we have really come from China when you start to look back on it, because they invented paper, they had porcelain, their figuring, their mathematics was they had mathematics before we even talked about figuring. They had paper printed way before long before even Europe was organized. And they had democratic system long before we even got organized.
Much older culture.
Yeah. And then only that, but they went to sleep, just like they stopped and forgot to wake up.
Mm-hmm. They seemed to have stopped at a certain stage and
yeah,
that was it.
That was it. Mm-hmm. I saw a water clock run with water. And it was, I don't know what age it was, and they had water clocks long before we had ordinary timepieces. Mm-hmm. So it goes to show that we have adopted a lot of their idea and improved them, and they still had them long before we had.
Yeah.
And the same with I've been down in the ship's yards, or the Chinese, they make their boats, the sampans and the dhows. And that's all done by handwork. They have no saw or any, they have their own saw. And it's no hand saw that one fellow is down in the bottom. They have a big teak log laying up on stilts. One is down on the bottom and one is walking on top, and they saw on the flanks out. There's no machinery. They heat, they have a flame, they put the fire on, they take the plank out, they heat it, they bend it, then put it on the ribbing. When they drill a hole, they have a little brass tube, and it sits, they have a little, kind of bow affair, and they pull this bowl and this little tubing makes a hole through the wood, and they put in a wooden plug.
Oh,
and if it's really fancy, they have brass spikes they put in. Mm-hmm. It's just remarkable what the way they do it. And they've been doing this for for centuries. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed my stay in them for that time, because there was a lot of things to see if you want to see them. And it was busy, and the Chinese are very courteous people. They are very friendly if you are friendly to them. They are happy people, they laugh and smile, and they bow, they don't shake hands like we do, they put our hands inside the sleeve and bow. And they are great for doing business with. They like they don't like to sell anything right offhand. They like to have a big long argument over this.
And they want to make a game out of it.
Yeah, they want to make a game of it. And if you can view them down, like you can, and still not buy it, and you can come back the next day and you still go through this thing again and have a cup of tea along with the man. And that I found quite a thing itself. I bought a lot of things there, man, to send back to Canada to friends of mine, and it never arrived because the ship got sunk. I mean, I enjoyed Chinese people. I really thought they were friendly and honest. You could go down in a store in Kowloon, buy anything you wanted and sign your name on a piece of paper. They call it chit or whatever. And he would come on and pay the and collect some money for the full amount. Say, come on, stay. And it was the easiest buying you ever laid eyes on. And that was a common thing in Hong Kong. All British colonies used to do that. Mm-hmm. And everything was cheap. Anything you wanted to buy was half of the price by carry. You got $4, four Hong Kong dollars to a Canadian dollar.
So your money went very far.
Oh yes, and we were overpaid. You see, because the imperial soldiers only got a quarter of what we got. And that caused a lot of bad feelings over there, because in camp you could have a Chinese servant. He would come in the morning, wake you up, lay your clothes out for you, have your shoe polished, shave you. That's it. Shave you right in bed if you want. You just raise up and he shave you. You get up and get dressed and go for your breakfast. He make your bed, roll up your mosquito netting, and you paid him 25 cents a week. Well, the Canadians got in there and they paid them a lot more on that, and the English couldn't afford that.
So they spoiled it for the English.
So they spoiled it for all of us, because the coolies got wise to that, that we had money, so they started to lift the price up. When I had a boy come in and he shine my shoes, take my clothes and get them washed and pressed and bring them back that afternoon. They were bought, changed, you had to change at noon at least, because the humidity is quite high and you sweat when you're on parade. So he bring it one set back, have fresh clothes to walk out at 5 o'clock. All this for hardly for nothing.
And they were happy to work.
When they were happy to work. And some imperials, they used to have a room downtown, down in Kowloon. And on the weekend, on long passage, they used to go and stay, and you could have quite comfortable little room downtown for about $4 to $5 a month. So it was, for a garrison, as we thought, a lot of us thought this was going to be a garrison. Just like Jamaica, there was just, it couldn't be, it was just a dream. Mm-hmm. So we were doing it fine. The food was fine. We had our own cooks. And some of the officers were even staying out at the Peninsula Hotel. Mm-hmm. Particularly the rifles.
Oh yes, the big rifles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because our officers were not quite as well off as the Quebec rifles. They were multimillionaires, some of them. You see, there was Ross and Clark's. And Clark's is the big steamship ownership on the Atlantic and the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. they had their own cook come out of that big hotel in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
So they could afford it. And our officers in the Grenadier were not well off. The only ones who were well off was Bardell.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't care. He could just well eat with one of the boys and enjoy it just as well as going to the fanciest hotel in town.
Mm-hmm. Bardell wasn't a man that cared about money.
No. He eat and drink the same as anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you were there, did you think about the Japanese on
the planet? Yes. You see, I do a lot of reading. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in reading. I read any book some person can lay my hands on. And I know that the Japanese were standing on the border. And we went out to have a look at it. So we know they were there. And then we had, I had an idea they were not there just for looking over this little border. They had some more ideas than that. And we were taking it not too seriously. The English were telling they wouldn't attack. We took their word for it. A lot of English people said the Japanese will never dare attack so long as the English flag is flying on Hong Kong.
They had that superior attitude?
Yeah, they had this. They were superior.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese disliked it too very much because when the English went on the sidewalk, the Chinese had to walk off the sidewalk. There's only where and there were sidewalks when the Imperial went down the sidewalk. The Chinese had to walk out on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And that was bad feelings too.
Chinese took to the Canadians?
Yes, I think there's lots of Chinese in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they correspond and they have more, they had more knowledge about Canadians, and they had more dealings with a lot of Chinese in Hong Kong had more dealings with Canadians than any other, and they know they are more freer people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think as a rule that the Chinese and the Canadian went along fine together. They are better mixers. English are hard to mix.
They're snobs.
Yeah, they are. They are great for servants. Every civil servant in Hong Kong had at least 3 servants or 4. He would have a houseboy, an ama, and a cook. That's the least. And if he had a car, he would have a driver. So then he went at 4. And that was all for, $10.
Mm-hmm.
You could have a couple of servants.
Mm-hmm.
You take the Chinese coolie some work in the ship guard, they got 25 cents a day in a bowl of rice. When you stop to think that's
heavy work.
That's awful work. Because you're chipping, particularly when you lay into dry dock and you have a boat laid up and you're going to take the barnacles off it and peel it. It's an awful work. It's dusty, dirty, it's
exhausting.
It's no end to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that for 25 cents. No wonder that the CPR could sail over there, get the boats done, and come back here and big, big profit.
Mm-hmm.
See? And the same, anything in labor, and the same in the dockyards where they were building ships, they build them for really nothing. And you had your overseer, the white, they were overseer. In China, Chinese would never get to be overseer. He would be second in command at the most. And that's so far could have the best education in the country, and he still wouldn't make more than a second.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I better get back to the war. Where were you when the battle started?
Well, I was on Aberdeen Island. We were detailed on a little island off Hong Kong Island. And we had packed our equipment in there, our ammunition, machine guns. And we were stationed on a little island. And on the morning, on the 7th, we saw some planes coming flying in for the dockyard. And we know by then that there was Japanese, and we were sitting in the trenches and watching this, and they dropped the bombs. You could see them coming down, and we thought for sure they were going to fall right in the trench. You know. And they fell about a half a mile away, at least. And they destroyed part of the dock gates and a couple of small boats there, Navy boats.
How many of you were on that island? Have you any idea?
One platoon. There would be about 30 men.
Mm-hmm. Who was your platoon leader, do you remember?
Our officer was Lieutenant Nugent. Mm-hmm. And we had a sergeant named Rutherford. And my corporal was Corporal Coote. And one thing happened there, we didn't get no... They forgot all about us, and we didn't have nothing to eat in it for one day there. We had one sausage apiece for one meal. So we stayed there for 4 days. And then we got orders to leave the island and turn back to Hong Kong. And as we walked into Aberdeen Harbor there, we saw the damage that had caused on the day there when they bombed, and they had naval bombardment during the night, and had done quite a lot of damage. So we were walking towards Aberdeen Reservoir. We arrived there later in the evening. It was dark, and we got orders to go up on Bennett's Hill. We did so. We tried to creep along the side of the hill to Bennett's Hill, and during the night, and we got there, and we only arrived there about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we got orders to return again. So we started back again, and we had quite a time getting back because
were you under fire then?
Yes, we were under fire. And we were under fire from the Japanese, and we come under fire from our own, because they had searchlights in the Aberdeen Reservoir, and they were shining on the Bennett's Hill, and we were coming down the slope on Bennett's Hill and crossing over, and we had to lay down in the mud and the rain, the wet. Every time that searchlight come sweeping along the side of the hill.
Was it Japanese searchlight?
No, that was our own.
Our own, oh yeah.
And they had the machine guns right in that clear. Mm-hmm. And we managed to get by. And about 5 o'clock in the morning, we were crossing the Aberdeen Reservoir there, and we run into to Sergeant Major Logan. He tells us that we should go into headquarters there at Aberdeen Reservoir, have a rest. We did, and we tried to get something to eat, and we only got heart attacks. We got the orders to go for one shy gap. We started out and we arrived in Wanxia Gap. We rested for a while and we left again to go to the peak. We got halfway to the peak and we stopped in a house for the night. In the morning, we got orders to return to Mount Karma. And we returned to Mount Karma and we stopped and headquarters gave us an order that we should go and try to reinforce Major Hook. That would be a big company. Not sure. Yeah. We started out from Wanxia Gap and we met part of Major Hook's company. Some were wounded and we kept on going down the road. And the last man to come in was Major Hook, and he was wounded. And he was the last one to come in. And he told Nugent that was a pretty bad place to go because the Japanese were coming up in force. And the order was given that we were going to go. So we started out and we left Major Hook and he returned to headquarters, to hospital. We kept on going towards the racetrack. And halfway to the racetrack, we got orders to try to proceed to Mount Cameron. And we were below Mount Cameron at that particular moment. And it's a steep hill, approximately, oh, I'd say 1,000 feet or so, maybe. And there's hardly any bush, very short grass, and hard to climb. And we were full equipment, gas mask, pack sacks. So I took part of my pack sack and I left it on the road. It held my souvenirs and my money. And I left it because I figured it wasn't doing me very much good where I was going. So I left my haversack there and part of the mount for the Bren gun we left behind because it was too heavy to carry, the tripod. We climbed Mount Cameron and got to the crest of it and we dug in, spread out and dug in. We stayed there that afternoon and we were under fire. That night, we were reinforced with another company and some English Imperials. And that's the first time we got hot food. On the 7th, and this would be about on the 20th. The firing was going on all that night, and in the morning we got orders to retreat back to Wanxia Gap. And we
had you lost the men?
No, we had not lost any men yet. And as we are retreating, we call all men in. And we missed one. One man had, he just missed. So we goes back to Wanxia Gap and retreat. So we get towards the peak again. And steading, then we are deciding what the officers are deciding what to do. And we get an order that we are going to go back to Wan Chai Gap and hold the fort again. So I get under Commando Captain Waddell. We are already we are confused. The platoon is split up. We have some men got to stop during the night and got in one place. Some got in some place where they were not supposed to be. So on. Waddell, he gives order that we find a place for the machine guns. Couple coots. Myself and Joe McLeod, you wouldn't know him. And he was from Lake the Bonnet, the three of us we were together all the time. So we advanced towards Wan Chai Gap, the Japanese are on Mount Cameron now, and they are firing right across the valley. So we had a machine gun, we set it up, and then we split up. Couple coots and McLeod is on one side and I'm sitting on one side and I have my rifles and I'm watching the Japanese on camera and I have two bandoliers on me. I have my pouches, I had my hand grenades in my pouches and my rifle. I take my pouches off and put them in there on the side of me there, and I took my little haversack and put it over on the side too, and I didn't remove my bandoliers. So I'm sitting there and watching the Japanese, and the first thing I know of flew right up in the air. And I wasn't wounded then. And then I realized that it was mortar shell, so my mind is working there for. So I trying to get in this hole. The second shell comes in and that throws me up in the air too, and I'm wounded right over the forehead there. Can't make that hole, so the top three shells comes in a cluster. So I got wounded the third time too, in the arm. Man, I am still not unconscious, and I know I have to get out of it because there's some more coming in. So I get up. My rifle is already broken in half, and some splinters just took the stock right off. My helmet is gone, so there's a road about 60 feet below me on the side of the hill. I'm trying to make this, and I get up and I'm gonna run over it. I get up on one leg, my other leg wouldn't work. It was cut off there and broken off. So I just threw myself on the side and I rolled over the hill, slid right down on the road. And another cluster of the shells come in and they miss me because I'm already down on the road. Mm-hmm. So there's an imperial comes along with a little car. Mm-hmm. He lost me. And he opens the door, he all by himself, and he said, "Hey buddy, if you can get in, hurry up." So I call in the car. I managed to get in there. I can't see, my eye is completely closed. My arm is gone too. I have no, and I got in it. So I'm happened to pass. I know I have to pass Waddell, and I'm still conscious. And so I tell him, "You stop here." I have to tell Captain Waddell I'm leaving. So Captain Waddell, he happens to look out and I say, "I'm sorry, and I'm leaving for the hospital." And I left the hospital, and Dr. Crawford, he was there. And,
which hospital was this?
That was at the Peak Hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Civilian. Mm-hmm. So as I come in there, a funny thing happened to me. I'm still unconscious. So the nurse, he gives me a glass of brandy. And that put me right out. I didn't know anything for on the 24th. This happened on the 21st or 22nd. Mm-hmm. And I'm laying in the hospital there, and I hear an awful bang. And there the Japanese were shelling, and the shells were dropping on the side of the hill of the hospital, and all the windows were taped, and a lot of the windows were broken. And the nurses were really wonderful. There was Asian nurses, you know, part Chinese and part white, like, you know, Asian. They were nice to us, and the food was very scarce there because they had no cooks there. We didn't have no bread there. And we had an officer with us. He made us some biscuits. There was lots of flour around and baking powder, so he made it biscuits there, and we sure enjoyed it. And from I stayed in that private hospital for to January.
Well, now tell me the extent. What was wrong with your leg?
Well, the bone, the main bone was broken, and part of my foot was penetrated. Mm-hmm. My left arm was wounded scrap metal had carded from the elbow to my shoulder. My bandolier had exploded and burnt and cut my chest bone in the between the chest and the, and my eye was only cut above it. There was nothing serious. I was worried more about the eye and my leg. Mm-hmm. And that was my injuries, my wounds. Then I got to hospital, and from the Peak Hospital, Japanese transferred me to Bowen Road.
Do you remember the Japanese coming in the hospital?
No. The Japanese come in the Peak Hospital, and they were officers and doctors, and there was no trouble at all there. They come on and asked if a man who he was, where he come from, and if you were Canadian or English, and they don't recognize that you change your nationality. So when he asked me who I was and where I was born, I told him I was born in Sweden. So they said they didn't take me as Canadian or English, they took me as Swedish, and they would take me out of the hospital. And then I told this Japanese officer that there was no chance I would be better off in the hospital, in the Peak Hospital, and being transferred out, because I didn't know who were going to look after me. I had my leg in a wooden box with a lid on top of it so they could do the dressing on it, and it was laying in here, and I couldn't move my arm. That was tied to the ceiling. So I couldn't see myself being sent out and tried to fend for myself, because I didn't know if there was a Swedish consul or not, if he would have the facility to pick me in and look after me or not. So I stayed. I got moved to Bowen Road Hospital, and I come under the care of Dr. Anderson. He was a civilian doctor in Hong Kong, and he was drafted by the Hong Kong Volunteers. And he looked after me.
Was he Scandinavian?
No, he was Scottish.
Oh, yeah.
And he had been a sergeant in China for many years. So he looked after me, and I stayed in Bowen Road Hospital for in bed there for approximately 2 years before I got up and could walk.
Do you attribute being in hospital so long to the fact that you didn't heal well with the diet?
Didn't heal well, you see. The food were lacking the vitamins and nutrients. They wouldn't heal. You see, my leg, I had, they tried all kinds of different systems to get my leg to heal. They forced it together in the end and put a bolt through the knee and a bolt through the below the ankle and then steel strap on the side, and they forced it together and then they bolted it. And I had that for about 7 months. And when I was able to get along quite well, because I got so used to it that it didn't bother me. And it was, nobody would come around you. You see, when you have a cast like that, where that was invented during the Spanish War, when they enclosed your wound completely in Paris plaster and let nature take its course to heal it. And the smell is
terrible.
You can just imagine. You have I was in a, what they call a death ward. Mm-hmm. It was the serious wounded were put in this ward, and it was not as big as this house, and the beds were two beds together, so close as you could get, and they were only just managed to walk in the little walk between the next bed, so the nurse and the doctor could walk in there. And they moved them on. He went on there, and gradually when you got back to that door again, chances are that you were going the other way. Mm-hmm. You might walk out, and chances are you were not. Mm-hmm. And I moved on that many, many times. Mm-hmm. I have one of them some stayed there too and walked out of it. Mm-hmm. And the smell in there was terrible, and I had very few visitors. Nobody come in there too often. And that was where I was found in the end. You see, the when Dr. Crawford, he did me up, he didn't give my chances were not too good. So they come out to headquarters that I had passed away. And I was at the Peak Hospital for quite a while. Went to Bowen Road, and I was laying in this ward there, and one day Kapala Kutsi was looking for me. He'd been looking all the time for me, see. And he found me there, and that's why I got back on the orphanage and that I was still there. Mm-hmm. And I stayed there for approximately 2 years before I got up. Mm-hmm. And Sister Christie, she used to look after me. And that's how we used to get rice. There was just boiling water, and mushy like. And I was really sick. I had gangrene had started in, and I was conscious at times and semi-conscious. And I just couldn't eat. Just couldn't do it. So I was laying on the balcony on the storm walk. All hospitals there have a walk outside. Mm-hmm. So I was laying out there, and Sister Christie, she found me one day, and she recognized I was Canadian. So she talked to me and said, "Anything you like?" I couldn't think of anything. Oh, she said, "I'll get you something to eat." So she managed to scone some white bread and some milk. She boiled it and she spoon-fed me. And from then on I started to eat. I ate rice after that.
That was the turning point, eh?
That was the turning point. So I got back. And from then on, I never had no trouble eating rice.
And how about your leg? Did you keep that bolt set up in it?
Yes, I kept that for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And that healed in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I got, Dr. Anderson, he said, I asked him often, because when you went down to the operating table there, there was no anesthetic, you know. You had to go through this torture, you know, picking the bones out there, you know. And mm-hmm. It got to the end, I couldn't stand the pain there, and just do a lot of noise. And he said, I am not going to take it out. You're going to walk back to with it. And I did too. And there was an accident happened there on the balcony when I was laying out there. The Japanese had, when they took Hong Kong, the shock troops or the really fighting troops, they took Hong Kong, and the Garons looked after the hospital too. When got there, there was one Japanese soldier there. Oh, he was there. Quite a mean-looking fellow, and he just come back by at nights, and he talked to you. Asked you, were you wounded? Yes, I was wounded. And I tried to explain to him, and I said that there was mortars who had wounded, and he said, oh, we are good at mortars, really good, and they were good too. So he used to give me some sweet biscuits, cookies, oh, what's the size, something like that. And every night he used to give me 3-4 of them have biscuits. Tastes really nice. So there was some imperials laying right above me. And he was awfully fond of cigarettes. He smoked anything. So he asked him for a cigarette one night, and he turned around and hit him with the rifle, but he was wounded. I don't know if, yeah, he was wounded too, because he was in bed. That's the difference of asking for he given you.
Okay, they're funny.
Very pure.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to tell me at the he asked me if I had a family. I didn't have no family. I wasn't married. And he said that he had 2 boys in Japan, and he hadn't seen them for 5 years. He had started in Upper China, got on to Hong Kong, and from Hong Kong they were going farther south. He eventually goes farther south. And he was a funny fellow. And their outlook in life was way different to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, but sign language, we got along fine.
Yeah.
And he was still, he was the only one I would say was really decent to me, only because I was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had no use for any unwounded men. They had no respect for them or anything. And they could tolerate a wounded a little bit. You see, I was laying on the balcony, and he had an inspection there. And there was an English medium named Boxer. And he tried, they had him out on the square in front of the hospital. And they interviewed him, Dr. Sato. He was walking down there, and made your box, so he stepped up and tried to explain to him that they need a medical supply or something in that line. And he slapped him right there. And made your box, so he was a really English gentleman. He was a carrier in the embassy. He could speak Japanese fluently, read it and write. And they didn't pay no attention to him. And that was the first time I saw a Japanese slap the knuckles off in wrong order.
Was that Dr. Sabin who slapped him?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I saw the governor, like Tokunaga, he used to come on, and he was a short, fat man, surly, never speak to anybody, or just pass through the walls, and that was it. And the same with the Red Cross, people come through, they put flowers in the walls, you know, and everything was nice and clean, you know. And then they take the Red Cross official through, and there was two Japanese with a rifle and bayonets, right? And they were just, it was just going right through, there was nothing to, you couldn't speak to them, you were told not to speak to them or make any sign to them. So that's how that went. And then in the meantime, well, like, you got beriberi, you got pellagra, you got dysentery, malaria, you had to contend with all them extra sickness. And some got so weak, you could have a dry beriberi, it didn't show too much, only that you got kind of paralyzed, you got numb, they started in your feet, and gradually you worked your way up in the body. And if you got wet beriberi, then you swelled up, it's just like dropsy, you put squeeze there and there's a couple of holes and you're full of water at all times. We had one fellow come home to the lodge, Sanderson. He had wet beriberi and he died of that there. He couldn't, very little you can do about him when they're going to such a state. Because they put the tube in and the water continually runs off your body.
Mm-hmm.
And that weakens the man too, because you have to get out of bed every 10 minutes if you can walk, you see. So I stayed in the hospital for 2.5 years. And then I asked to be sent to Shemsapo camp. I got sent to Shemsapo camp in 1944. And as I'm leaving the hospital, Dr. Sato and Major Boone, I don't know if you heard of, but Major Boone, on the landing, the inspector my kit. I had the only little kit bag, and I had some Japanese pictures. And pictures I had took in Hong Kong during the fighting. And I put the pictures out in the open, in a little pile, and the Japanese officer, he come on and he asked me, "You want to go to camp?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Is that all you have?" "Yes," I said. So he looks at it, the picture laying right in this little pile, and I had some of the pictures, you know, the more valuable, had them stuck on in the bottom, like more. Mm-hmm. But so he said, "Okay, you can take it with me." Major Boone, he comes right behind it. He is not satisfied. He opens them up and looks at them, and then he calls the Japanese officer back. And the Japanese officer has to look in. He puts his, he looks through them and he takes some, and then he puts his hand on his sword, you know, and he looks at me and he didn't say nothing, and he just looked me over. And
you were shaking in your boots there?
I was shaking, I was really scared.
Why did Boone do that?
I don't know, that's a kind of fact, I can't understand that. And he let me go. And I was glad that to go too, because that was the closest call I had. where it goes, because even the officer, he know me by sight. He had spoke to me quite a few times, because I was Swedish, and he once sent me out. Mm-hmm. And then I arrived in camp.
What did you think when you walked in? How did the men look to you? You hadn't seen them?
That was the biggest shock to me. I've seen a lot of things. I've seen some men come in terrible shape, and I hadn't seen them under this condition. They were sleeping on concrete floors, only a couple of blankets. And it's just, you can't imagine how it looked to me. And my friends found me, and they took me in. There was Cecil MacArthur and Williamson and Colvin and a couple of other friends. They took me in, and they were all in little groups, 3-4 together, usually 4 or 5. Some, and then they go to working parties, and they, whatever they scrounge, they pull it together. Well, I couldn't work because I was walking on crutches. So they got me a little easy job in the kitchen, cutting vegetables and leaves and things like that. And during the day and on the night, when the other boys could sleep, I used to stand guard, stand beside the entrance to the hut. And when the Japanese sentry come around, he'll ask how many is in the hut, and you tell him how many was in it. And if somebody was to the toilet, you tell him. And that way my friends, he could sleep and go to work. Otherwise they would have to stand guard, you see. And I could sleep once in a while during the time. Nobody took notice to me. Mm-hmm. Well, I contacted Barry then. And so I was sent to a hospital in Shamsapur. And that turned into Barry. I got paralyzed in my legs, couldn't walk no more. I couldn't feed myself either. So Dr. Gray, he was a Canadian doctor, he said, "Well, he'll send you back to a Bowen Road hospital." So they got permission from the Japanese officer to send me to a hospital. And he gave the permission. And I was sent back to Bowen Road. And as I'm laying on the dock, there was a man come on and said that the invasion of Normandy had took place. And that's the first good news that we had. And that was in June. I went back to Bowen Road Hospital, and Dr. Anderson looked after me again and got me going.
Did he give you any needles? Yes.
I got nicotine acid. Mm-hmm.
Did that help?
Yes, I think it did. Because, and then you got a shot of nicotine acid, and you got one egg. You got one teaspoon of peanut butter, and that can help you to get nutrition back. And then I had two friends in the hospital. They used to pick me up out of the bed and lift me up, and I had to try to walk. So it was, they had me between them, and they that make me walk, and I got walking. So, and I got over that, and then I got dysentery, so I was sick again. But I managed to get over that too. And then I got malaria the same year, all in the same 44. So, and I got over that also. And then we got changed from Bowen Road Hospital, we went to the Central Chinese School. And that was located at at Kitek, just above Kitek, close to Argyle camp. And that is where I stayed to the end of the hostility.
And the hostelry?
Well, it was the same setup, only it was more area and not quite as crowded. You see, Bowen Road was taken out for the Japanese own prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to we went back to Sham Sapu because we were in one area. We went back to Sham Sapu once for Christmas, and the Americans started an air raid in the morning, and it lasted for an hour all day. I was sleeping in a little room. There was three of us, and the explosion from one of the bomb ones was so strong that it took the door off and put it against the other wall. Two of them, one was went underneath the bed. I was laying on top of the bed because I couldn't get on that well. And that was close call too, and there was no bombs at the internment camp at all that time. It only bombed the harbor. And it come so close that you could see the markings on the plane as it dropping down.
I guess the guys were cheering them on.
Oh, yes, man. We didn't dare go outside. And one fellow got injured by flak. They were, the Japanese were firing flaks, and the shrapnel were falling down, and he got hit in the shoulder. His name happens to be Anderson, too. And he was a Hong Kong volunteer. He was the only one I seen some was injured during that attack. And then we went back to Chinese school again, and we stayed there. And the last day before the surrender, though, before it got known, there was two Americans that had got captured. They had been landed by a submarine, and they were sending weather and information of ships passing them. And the Japanese captured them, and they didn't execute them. They took them in close to the school and told them, walk. And that's his son. You can walk, you're free to go. And they didn't know what to do, because automatically they executed any prisoners they took in that category.
Espionage, yeah.
Yeah. So they walked into the school, and I was talking to them, and one said, they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and it took the city right off. So we were listening to them, and you know, we took that as quite a joke, because we didn't really believe it. Not we know bombs are pretty good size, because we've seen them,
mm-hmm.
and not that big.
Mm-hmm. So you thought it was more American baloney?
Yeah. So they told us the war is going to be over either this week or next week. We are sure of that. So then we started to talk this thing over, and we decided there must be something to it, because otherwise, why would they let them two fellows go into this hospital and not do nothing with them? So our Colonel Bowie was in charge of our hospital. He went to Dr. Sado and asked them, have you got anything to tell us? And Dr. Sado, he said, I got nothing to tell you. That night for that afternoon, the Chinese coolies had been walking up in front of our hospital, and they had shown the V-sign all day.
Showing you the victory sign?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And when Dr. Sato said to Bowie, I got nothing to tell you. That night, all the guard come to the barracks and they burned all the files, all papers that were collected and burned in the yard, in the courtyard. And all the pack sacks of the soldiers were packed and stacked, and the rifles were stacked and they marched out. We know that the war was over. We didn't know how serious it was going to be. So we went down in the Japanese quarters and we looted what was left.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to get a typewriter.
Japanese typewriter?
Yeah. And some equipment for hospital. They had confiscated from our own hospital. So I returned it to Dr. Anderson. Then the Japanese didn't tell us anything. And they left only one guard on the main gate. And we went out and talked to him. And he said, the war is over. And you can go wherever you want. So the next morning, I went to our hospital and I walked to Shamsapo.
How far would that be?
Oh, but 4 or 5 miles.
You too, eh?
Yeah, with a friend of mine. We stopped in at some Chinese place, in the residential area, and they gave us some tea and cookies. That was the first eatables we had in a free way.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Shamsapo. And from Shamsapo I went on the dock and had a look around there, and it happened to be a Canadian destroyer, corvette really, some had escorted us into Hong Kong, had returned and were docking when I was found there.
But that was a wonderful sight
to you. Oh, it was nice, and we got fresh bread and fresh butter and food, and well, there was no end to it. And then the Americans were dropping parachute food bundles and anything you could think of they dropped in. And the Japanese then interned themselves. They didn't do nothing to us. They didn't help us. They just left us strictly alone.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's all right, don't worry about
it. They could made things awkward for us, but they didn't.
Defeat is a terrible thing to a Japanese.
Yes, it is. Particularly to some of the higher class Japanese, they took that serious. And then when the Americans took over and the Australians come in there, well, then they started to arrest somebody. Dr. Sato took an auger, and the only one I don't think they arrested right when I was in Hong Kong was the last Japanese interpreter. He was a minister by profession, like he had been in the States and was ordained, like, and he was a civilian, and he was just as bad off as we were.
He was forced to that.
Because he was forced to it, and he could not dispute anything, because they would execute him just like he would done to us.
I wonder where he is.
He is still living in Japan. I have a book he wrote. I have it in my bookshelf there. And he was a very nice gentleman. He took out a gold ring of mine to be sold on the Japanese market. And for that I got a dozen duck eggs and some silver and some salt. You see, anybody some had gold rings or anything in gold, you could sell it on the black market, because the North Koreans and Formosans, they would trade anything. And it was fortunate. Mm-hmm. And it really was too late in the last year, because, well, you had pellagra and beriberi so bad that it took quite a lot to get the vitamins working.
Mm-hmm. So then what happened to you?
Well, then I got an Empress of Australia that was took us to Manila, and we got a medical there in the American hospital, and we had a choice, so either fly home or go by boat. So I didn't like the Empress Australia, so I got on an American hospital ship, Admiral Wardman, and they looked after me. By the way, when I got to Manila, the Americans, they come in at night to Manila camp. They had the clothing for us. They gave us $100 and all the equipment. And the next day we went to the canteen. You couldn't buy anything. They didn't take any money. You got everything for nothing. So you had $100 in your pocket. You didn't know what to do with it. And the same happened on the boat. When I got on the boat, I was put in hospital, sick bay. And they give you chocolate, ice cream, anything you wanted to eat. The cook used to send up a list and ask you what you would like to have to eat. So I asked for a chicken. So what do I get? I get a whole chicken. I couldn't eat even a quarter of it. And the American treated us real wonderful. Couldn't be any better. And then I was 17 days coming over from Manila. And we landed, I think we landed at Frisco. And we got put on a train and we went to Seattle. And from Seattle, wait a minute, I think it's Seattle, isn't it? From Seattle to Vancouver, to Victoria. And I stayed at Camp Gray for a week. And Dr. Crawford, he put the through the medical there. And then I got leave.
Did you feel yourself picking up all the time? Picking up?
Yeah. Oh, yes. I was really, that 17 days on the boat had was the best time I ever had, because that really, he really looked after me there. He gave me, I didn't have no chance to get on. And, I was fed and looked after, and it was just wonderful. And then I got to Point Grey, and the doctor gave me, Dr. Crawford gave me leave. And I visited some people in Moose Jaw and stayed there. And I returned to Deer Lodge in January. And I stayed at Deer Lodge and had operations on my legs, and my teeth had went bad in the meantime, and that had was looked after. And then in fall of 46, I think I was sent to Portage. And in 47 I was released from bodies and they are large. And I was out for some time, and then I got married. I worked for Manitoba Telephone for 4 years, I believe, or 5 years, and I got employed by the federal government and worked for the RCMP for up to 70.
Mm-hmm. And how does your leg bother you?
Oh, I have my aches and pains. Mm-hmm. And then, not too bad.
Mm-hmm. How about your eyes?
Well, my eyes have deteriorated over the years.
Mm-hmm. And how about your stomach and all the other parts?
Well, my stomach is fine. I never had enough trouble since I had dysentery.
So, except for the battle injuries, you didn't do too bad?
No.
And is there anything you want to say, any comment? What pension are you on?
Well...
Have you got your 100%?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about the whole thing?
Well, all I can say, it was an experience.
Mm-hmm. You would go through it again?
And I don't want to go through it again, though.
How do you feel about Japanese people?
Oh, I have no bad feelings against them, because they are the same as me. They had no choice in the matter, and I think that we contribute part of.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't start this by themselves, by long ways. We contribute in politics and everything else in business way too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, no, I have to speak to Japanese, and I have friends Japanese now, mm-hmm. So I have no...
You have no...
It's... If I feel really bad, but was like a fellow like Major Boone,
mm-hmm.
Red Bowen, that was his staff sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
That's the people I...
Because they were your own men.
They were my own kind people. Mm-hmm. And they turn around and do things to punish.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw Major Boone go out there in the morning and bow towards the sun, you know, with his shaved head, I thought that was just not good.
That disgusted you?
Yeah.
Where is he today?
I haven't so slight to see this.
Was he a grenadier major, or was he...
Oh, no, he was an English.
He was an English
one. Oh, yeah. Okay. So was Red Baum. Harvey was English, too.
Tugby.
Tugby was Canadian. So.
Mm-hmm. And how about Kamloops? Did you ever have any...
I only seen him once.
Mm-hmm.
He never... I was very fortunate that I was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't help me. They didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that any difference between the officers of the Quebec Rifle towards their men in comparison to the officers of the Grenadiers towards their men?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
You think the Grenadiers were better?
Yes, I think so. They were more... They were close and more common men.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they weren't... they worked, a lot of them worked for their living the same as I did, you
mm-hmm.
see. Whereas some of the Quebec officers never worked in their life, never even didn't know how to spell it, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
They take a clerk. Well, he was flown home. They had money, could afford to fly him home.
Mm-hmm. He never got close to his men.
Oh, no. He never. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. kvinna på. Men it was officers like Bardell, Phillips, Corrigan, McKagan. There were officers just like ordinary men.
Well, I interviewed Park and he said he stayed right with the men. He didn't go with you.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen Parks for years.
Well, you should go and see him. He's retired too.
Is he?
Yeah.
And
and he's great, just like you, sitting around having a good time.
Right, yeah. Hang on. Nugent, he was a young officer. Mm-hmm. He was, I was a lot older on him for that matter, and he used to come out of school, you know. He didn't, it was something out of line altogether. The situation there didn't follow no rule books at all.
Yeah. Our boys fought well, didn't they?
Oh, yes. I say they did the best they could under the circumstances, because they supply for weapons were not what it should be.
Yeah. Equipment wasn't there.
No, the equipment wasn't there.
Yeah.
You take, we didn't have, I didn't see a mortar over there in my own outfit.
No.
And the Japanese, they had them, he could spare a dozen. Mm-hmm. And still had lots of them.
Did you go back on that trip?
No, I didn't.
If you want to see a hospital, you can go downtown.
I can go downtown. I can go to the lodge. And you take Corrigan. He was he had worked on the railroad,
mm-hmm.
and the gang, and right on the track together with the men. And he was a good officer. He was rough.
I heard him. He was a tough guy.
Yeah. And that's the kind of officers you really needed over there. And that. And you needed the equipment too.
You needed men that could. I spoke to a lot of men, and they were capable, under the situation, to adjust quickly.
Oh yes.
Change position.
When you give a Canadian, you get a bunch of Canadians together in a passing camp, and they can invent things whom you never dreamed of.
Mm-hmm.
When I come to camp, I was quite surprised. He said, "Come in, and we'll have some tea." And I know there was no such a thing as fireplaces in huts.
Mm-hmm.
So I come in, and Williams and he made a pot of tea, he had a tin can and plugged it in, got it in the light bulb. And here they had to put the wires in the bottom, and it was just like a kettle.
Electric kettle.
Yeah, it was just a tomato candle.
Mm-hmm.
And then one stand at the door and watch so the sentry didn't come on and catch us doing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with radios. They had radio in Champs-Apo, and that was made it by themselves, and each one carried a little piece, mm-hmm. in his pocket. And when they all got together, they had a little crystal receiver.
Mm-hmm. They're very inventive.
Oh, the time and the circumstances makes that you use everything.
Mm-hmm.
We had one fellow some started knitting. He knitted socks, unravel your sweater, and he make a pair of socks, because there was, you couldn't get no socks. It was shoemakers. He got hold of old rubber tires and cut them out, put the strap over, and that was your shoe.
Mm-hmm. And look at you, you did wood carving?
Oh yes.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do
you
something.
Had to do some
stuff. Oh yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You took that piece of wood and you carved it with a bed spring, eh?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Did you get any reading material? Did anybody bring you a book? Okay. Where were we now?
On the book.
On the book, reading material.
Well, you see, we got a shipment in of books in 44.
Mm-hmm.
And to begin with, the hospital in Bowen Road had quite a well-supplied library there. All kinds of books, and people brought in books with them. And we got a fresh supply of books from some Red Cross society. I'm not sure if there was a Geneva Red Cross or not. And we got books in, and we had all opportunities to read. Mm-hmm. Any both history mm-hmm. and religious books, mm-hmm. Bibles and so forth. Mm-hmm. And
so that kept you going.
That kept me going. I'm very interested in reading, so I was always busy, plus playing cribbage.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, you were a cribbage player,
yeah.
Right?
So mm-hmm. I did all right. Mm-hmm.
Did you gamble?
No.
You're not a gambler?
No, I'm not a gambler. Mm-hmm. There was, mind you, at the played bridge, was played a lot, mm-hmm. and chess.
Mm-hmm. Did people from town of Hong Kong come to visit you guys in the hospital, or were they not allowed here?
Oh, no. No, they were not. Never.
No.
I saw the only one some visited the hospital was Mrs. Han. I don't know if you ever heard that name. She's in, she writes books. It was a newspaper lady. And she was the first lady I saw come in on the hospital through the Japanese lines.
Mm-hmm.
I got a couple of books she wrote about Hong Kong also.
She did write
yeah.
about them.
And she was a friend of Major Boxer also.
Mm-hmm.
And she was quite a lady. She was the first lady I seen smoke cigars.
Oh yeah. So she was quite a
traveler. Yeah, she was a traveler. She traveled all through China and
very well educated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speak Chinese and speak Japanese.
Did you learn some Japanese words?
Well, you had to learn a certain amount.
Mm-hmm.
Name or different things and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And some young Canadians had like a couple of coots, mm-hmm. a sergeant coots. He could speak Japanese quite fluently mm-hmm. and understand it.
Well, I think that's everything. It certainly gave me a way.